Hello, I'm Rob Friedman, and welcome to Team Talk. On this episode, we have Apollo, who is a vice president at Dimensional Fund Advisors, and Team Hewins, chief investment officer, John. We've just completed a live webinar for our clients with John and Apollo, and I'm looking forward to continuing the conversation here on the podcast. John?
Thanks, Rob. We had a really great conversation about diversification. And sort of the heart of the point was, we refer to the great legendary investor, Warren Buffett, who for decades has counseled individual investors that the smartest thing they can do is just go ahead and buy an S&P 500 index fund. And when you look certainly at recent performance over these last few years, it looks like his advice was as sound as ever. So why shouldn't we all just listen to Warren and just buy that index and be done with it? So to help get some more perspective on ways to go beyond Warren's advice, we're going to have this conversation with Apollo Lupescu from Dimensional Fund Advisors. Dimensional is one of the largest and premier investment managers in the world. Apollo's role at Dimensional is that he's responsible for communicating Dimensional's academic foundations and investment beliefs, both to professionals and individual investors alike. He's considered the secretary of explaining stuff because he really excels at delivering a thought-provoking presentation in a clear and understandable way. Apollo's been with Dimensional for over 16 years. Prior to that, taught at the University of California, has also run his own consulting firm, has a PhD in economics and finance from UC Santa Barbara and a BA in economics from Michigan State, where he was also water polo player and coach. And so thank you, Apollo, for joining us. So let's just start it out with that basic question. Why don't we just follow Warren's advice? And should everyone just invest in an S&P 500 index fund?
Hi, Rob. Hi, John. Thank you so much for the invitation to be on the podcast. And, you know, let me start by saying that the Warren's advice is certainly warranted, if you think about it, because what he has been suggesting to individuals is not to engage in stock picking or trying to identify the next high flying company or sector. What he has been suggesting is that today, given how competitive the nature of the stock market has become, to the point where there are more professionally managed mutual funds in the U.S. Than actual stocks trading on the market, it is really, really hard to believe that anybody can consistently get a competitive advantage when they go and trade in the market. Because for every buyer, there has to be a seller. For every pessimist, there has to be an optimist. And the way that information flows today, the way that the access of information has been democratized, it is really, really, really hard to imagine that today somebody can consistently create that competitive advantage when it comes to going in the market and outperforming on a consistent basis. So his notion is that given where the markets are today, the conditions that are this century, the investment approach should move away necessarily from individual security selection, from the stock picking that maybe was the norm a while ago, to something that is much more diversified, trying to capture the global productive capacity, or in this case, the productive capacity of the U.S. economy in a low-cost, tax-efficient way. And that's why he has been suggesting to people. So the core insight of Warren Buffett's suggestion is certainly valid. You know, stock picking is not what it used to be. It's not necessarily where the puck is going. If you remember Gretzky saying that, you know, what made him successful is not chasing where the puck used to be, but where it's going next. And what he's suggesting that individual stock selection or sector selection, that's in the years past. Looking forward, it's much more about broadly diversified, tax-efficient, cost-efficient solutions, which is what the S&P could be.
Right. So the other thing that you want to make sure people don't, remember is that the S&P 500 is all equities, right? You put all your eggs in the S&P 500 basket, you're 100% invested in the stock market. And particularly if you're, you know, about to enter retirement, you're in retirement, probably not the best idea to be 100% in equity. given the nature of equity volatility. So if you want to touch on, you know, fixed income allocations or what fixed income can do for the in your mix to lessen volatility.
Right. And I think that's the key insight that when you look at Warren's advice, that is part of the puzzle, but it's not the whole thing. It's a piece of the puzzle. Because as you said, what Warren is suggesting, if you want to participate in the stock market, that's the way to do it. And I think going beyond Warren's advice, the first thing that you ought to think about is exactly what he said, John, which is not only how do you buy ownership in companies, which is what you do in the stock market, because that ownership allows you to partake in profits. But we know that profits fluctuate, and as profits fluctuate, so does the value of companies, and that's where the market fluctuates, and it's a normal thing to happen. And we've seen some of these fluctuations not only these days, but historically, that on a daily, monthly, or annual basis, the market goes up and down quite tremendously. And one of the ways to kind of buffer a little bit against that is to not only buy ownership in companies, but have a second instrument that is available on publicly traded markets, which is important because there is transparency, disclosure, liquidity. And the second element in this public markets is not just ownership, but lending money. You can lend your money to corporations and governments through a contract that specifies an interest rate that you will receive. So in that regard, it's spelled out in the contract how long you'll receive that interest rate. And at the back end, you get your principal back. That is called a bond. So when you do a bond, when you buy a bond, it's very, very different, the experience that you have as an investor, because you take away the uncertainty of what would be the profits, how will these fluctuate. In this case, you know exactly how much you get paid for the duration of the contract. And in that respect, bonds tend to be a little bit like ballast in a boat. So if you want to go fast, you basically put out the sail, but then it's very choppy. It's all over the place. And that's what stocks do. They make you go fast, but it's a very bumpy ride. If you want some stability in your ride, then you put some ballast and you don't go as fast, but you also have a smoother ride. So that's in a way how to think about stocks and bonds. Bonds are the ballast of your portfolio, and the speed comes from stocks. And everybody ought to have a different balance, because there's some people who are young and maybe it's okay for them to catch more speed. But you know, at some point, as you go to retirement, maybe you want some more stability. You don't want to just want to eat well because the stock market grows more, but you also want to sleep well. And so that fundamental balance between stocks and bonds is the most important decision in investing. And the only way to get it right is to work with an advisor like Tim Huens and make sure that you have a financial plan that takes account of your personal circumstances. When do you need the money? How much money do you need? Are you a business owner or not? That matters. Do you have a pension or not? What's your risk capacity? All of these inputs are important in crafting a plan that's customized to your needs. And then based on that plan, an advisor can ultimately determine what might be the appropriate allocation between stocks and bonds. But it's a crucial piece, because bonds tend to hold up really well when stock markets drop. And in general, they do give a lot more stability than stocks. That's been a historical precedent with bonds.
Okay, so you made the case for trying to build that ballast in, but let's go back to the equity side. Again, got to remember, when you say S&P 500, you're only talking about U.S.-based companies, and there's a big world out there. So what about incorporating international equities into your program and going from being pure U.S.-based to global? Worth doing?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. When we're talking about investing, and Warren has been talking about the S&P 500, that S&P 500 is a list of some of the largest companies in the U.S. economy. And it turns out there's a global marketplace. And the same way that we have in the U.S., Ford and GM, certainly there's a BMW in Germany and a Toyota and Honda in Japan. So intuitively, if we think about holding Ford and GM, why not consider BMW and Toyota? In my pantry, I have Kraft mac and cheese, but I also have Nestle products. Family members have Samsung and Apple phones. So to me, it is intuitively, it absolutely makes sense, because international investing is not about countries as much as it is about companies. And some of these companies that we know and love might not even be traded on the U.S. market. Next to my house, I have two 7-Elevens, and those 7-Elevens are, the 7-Eleven is not a company that's traded on the U.S. stock market, but rather it's a Japanese stock market. So so to me, it is conceptually, it makes sense to go around the globe. And what we've seen looking at the numbers is that historically, the U.S. Has never been the best performing stock market among the 45 or so different stock markets available to investors over the past 20, 30 years. There's always some other country that did better. And in fact, if you look at last year, the U.S. Did pretty well. But when you look at the MSCI indices that are on their website, what you see is that a country like Russia was the best performing, and in fact better than the U.S. So there's always a different country that does better. But the other important thing about investing globally is not necessarily about capturing opportunities, because it's important about it, but it's also about diversifying and realizing there are times when the U.S. is doing very well, and we're going through a decade like that. The last decade, the U.S. has done very, very well, and international markets haven't done as well. And that's okay, because in a way, if you have components in your portfolio that do not move in lockstep, that creates an opportunity for diversification. Doesn't mean you're not going to lose money. It just, it doesn't protect against loss. What it does, it creates a smoother ride. The more pieces that don't move in lockstep that you have, the more the portfolio benefits when it comes to a reduction in portfolio volatility. And that's just pure math. I mean, this is just nothing more than math. So it is a good that the U.S. is doing well. Historically, when you look over decades, it's not consistently that every decade the U.S. has done better. And I think that's a really important reason why you want to have both international and U.S. And the last comment I'll make on this, John, is that when we look at international stocks, I'm not sure that what people are considering, but it's not that all the money's invested. The preponderance of the money, the bulk of the money, is invested in the U.S. Because when we look at the value of all companies that are part of the U.S. market, they account for about 54% of the value of all companies around the world. So in that respect, obviously the U.S. is going to be the big kahuna. That's where the bulk of the money is. And that's a starting point. And most often what you see is that advisors might adjust that number from 54%, which is called a natural market weight, to maybe either emphasize or de-emphasize the U.S. By a little bit. And this is, again, part of the art of the science. And that's what you, John, and I know that I've known you for a long while, that's part of the process that you have in your committee to figure out how much do you want to put in U.S. companies, how much in countries that are developed like Germany or France or Japan, Australia, and a third category called emerging markets. And that is something that Team Hewins analyzes, and you come up with your own allocation for your clients. So that's something that obviously it's not something that's you determine. So you're better off approaching that, because I don't know if I that's something that would be interesting for me to hear, like how you approach it and
what. Right. So we've been global investors for since we started. As a firm, we have pretty healthy exposure to non-U.S. equities. When you look at the total market value of the globe, of all the companies, publicly traded companies out there, 54% of the market value is based in the United States. We are at 60% U.S. So we're a little overweight the U.S. relative to its actual dollar value vis-a-vis the rest of the world. But we take into consideration the reality that our clients are all U.S.-based investors, that their expenses are in dollars, and comfort level. So we've landed at 60%. And then of the 40% that's outside the U.S., 30 percentage points is dedicated to the developed markets across Europe and Asia, and, primarily, and North America. And 10 percentage points is dedicated specifically to the emerging market space, which, of course, covers mainly Asia, as well as Latin America and Eastern Europe and parts of the Middle East and Africa. So that's our strategic approach to building out our global portfolios. In that light, I want to ask you, Paula, again, going beyond, what more can we do when you're looking at asset classes or sub-asset classes in terms of diversifying away from the S&P 500? So what else you got for us?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question because, you know, I mentioned to you that in the U.S. there are roughly about 3,000 companies that can be bought and sold with pretty good liquidity, whether it's on NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange, Amex. There are all these stock exchanges in the U.S. where you can trade these companies. And just by doing the math, the S&P 500 reflects on the largest 500 companies, which means that our, you know, 2,000 plus other companies in the U.S., which are not part of the U.S. stock market, and some of them are household names, some might not be. So when you look at small companies these days, you know, we certainly have on the large side, McDonald's, which is a well-known burger chain. And we also have Shake Shack. And I have both of those literally like not far from my house. So when I think of these two, they're both restaurants that sell burgers, but one is a lot larger than the other. Now, McDonald's is in the S&P. Shake Shack is not. So why do I think it's important? Well, these smaller companies, what you find is that they don't have the same robustness that the large companies have in terms of the track record and the deep pockets and the ability to withstand different things. And in that respect, they certainly economically tend to be different. And they also have a bit of a high opportunity to grow, because if I look at McDonald's and Shake Shack, just as an illustration, I can see Shake Shack doubling easier than McDonald's would. So small companies do carry, you know, particularly in times like this, they don't seem to be as deep pockets and as mature as the large ones. It just turns out that they also have bigger growth opportunities. So one of the ways in which you can diversify is not all your money in the U.S., not in the U.S. large companies, which is the S&P is, but rather also tap into the opportunity set that is presented by the smaller companies. And what's interesting is that historically, if you look over the long run, these smaller companies, they did tend to give investors a bigger opportunity for growth. And in fact, you know, academics and practitioners, they do believe that smaller companies do have higher expect the returns going forward than large companies. And when you look at that, it makes sense to diversify it. And once again, it's not about piling all the money in small companies, but it's also about looking and saying, if instead of putting all the money in large, should I be taking a portion of that and putting into small? And it's again, it's a decision that advisors make, and it's a very important decision. And I know you guys have a process at Hewins to determine this allocation between large and small, for example.
Right. Again, we've always had dedicated allocation to smaller companies. And because of this data that shows long-term outperformance of small companies versus large companies, we've always been strategically overweight on a relative basis. So while the very broad indices, for example, there's the Russell 3000 Index, which includes large, mid, and small cap companies, today, the Russell 3000, the top holding by market value is Microsoft, and it represents just under 5% of the index. I think it's 4.8 at the end of the last quarter. The bottom 2,000 companies in the Russell 3000 only represent 5.1% of the index. So if you want to get the exposure to small stocks and their long-term outperformance, they have to be a meaningful enough part of your portfolio. So our decision, our investment committee, is that we've allocate 25% of our domestic equity exposure is dedicated to the small cap space, which is substantially higher than, say, the Russell 3000 index. But again, we really want to capture that long-term outperformance. And we are picking up lots of diversification. I mean, you could have pick the top 5% of the index. That's just one company. Or the bottom 5% of that Russell 3000 is 2,000 companies. It really is pretty startling. Normally, that relationship between what the Russell 2000, the bottom 2,000 represent out of the 3,000 is more like 8 to 10%. So we're at a historically wide gap in valuation between large companies and small companies. And then Apollo, you touched on also just the base on our webinar about valuation differences between companies that have lower valuation metrics versus growth companies with high valuation metrics. And again, that relationship is pretty blown out. And you gave an example, I think, between Amazon and Intel, if you could.
Right. So, this is the what's interesting is that that even within large companies and small companies, the academic community and also the practitioners, going back to the 1990s and even the 80s, what they found is that there are differences in expected returns between companies with different relative prices. And what I mean by that is that when you're buying a company, you have to find out what is the relative price. How much does it cost me to buy a dollar of earnings or a dollar of book value? That's something that we believe is a way. It's a good way to implement in a real portfolio is the book value, and when you look at the price for, let's say, a dollar of earnings, that's another way to look at it. All of these are metrics that shine a light on how a relative prices impact investors' expect returns. And what we see is that in value, the value companies are basically the ones with a lower relative price. So when you compare them, different companies, you have different prices. And what John is referencing is that if you look right now on your phone, and this is just for illustration, this is not how portfolios are managed, just to get a sense of this intuitive aspect of what a value company versus a growth would be. If you look right now at something called price earnings, and that's not something that we use, just to make sure that just for illustration purposes, that tells you how expensive is to buy a dollar of earnings from a company. And right now, if you compare how much would it cost you to buy a dollar of earnings from a large company like Amazon relative to a smaller company like let's say Intel, large company with a different relative price like Intel, it's a vast difference. A dollar in Amazon to buy the same dollar of earnings in Amazon, it would cost you five times more than it would cost you to buy it from Intel. It's the same dollar of earnings. That's what the price earnings looks at. And to me, that's the idea is that what you want to find is how expensive it is to buy these companies. And a good analogy there is if you have two houses on the same block, and one sells for, let's say, $200 a square foot, the other one for $100, $1,000 a square foot. And they're, you look at it as an investor, well, which one would give you a better opportunity to basically, sell it later and make money, the low cost one or the high cost one? It's a fundamental principle in economics. So to me, absolutely, we do think that value has economic underpinnings, but also the data shows that low price companies, particularly when you look at the price to the book value, tends to be a really good way to build a portfolio and try to capture these higher expected returns.
Right, and I think I had some numbers just on price to book of small versus large today as well, kind of where that stands.
Yeah, I I mean, I think that that one way that, that investors can do it is look at the reporting websites and find that the price to book for different funds for different indices, and it just it's really like I could try to give you the numbers. It's just by the time you look this up, you'd find that maybe those numbers change. So the best thing I can tell you right now is that large companies that are expensive, large growth companies, that's what expensive normally, it's a relative price is higher. Those large growth companies, their price to book in terms of how much it costs you to book, to buy a dollar of book value, right now roughly is in the neighborhood of 10. So if you wanted to buy $1 billion in book value, it costs you about $10 billion to get that. For small value, it's less than a dollar. So if you wanted to buy $1 billion in book value from a small value company, or asset class, not company, an asset class, you would spend less than $1 billion. So it's this idea of, you know, the relative cost, how expensive is a company. And right now, by historical measures, these large growth companies do tend to have pretty high valuations.
In terms of, and we can kind of wrap it up here a little bit, Paulo, but just to sort of put it all together, if you had just some thoughts of, all right, you know, what should my expectations be as I have built now a portfolio that includes a healthy allocation to bonds, international stocks, both developed and emerging, strong allocation within equities to small cap, potentially build some tilt towards value stocks to capture that differential in valuation between growth and value. What are some things to think about in terms of, now that I've done that, about to keep my expectations in the right place?
Right. Well, you brought a few things that let's touch on. The first one, the experience that you would have as an investor would be very different, because the S&P would be one piece of that of the puzzle. So you'd have multiple pieces. One of them would be the S&P. But because you have some bonds which tend to not fluctuate as much in value, because you have international stocks, small cap stocks, the experience that you would get is that depending on the level of bonds that you have, you could have a smoother ride in a portfolio that's more heavily allocated towards bonds than the U.S. market as a whole. So in that respect, I think talking to your advisor, going to your financial plan and figure out exactly what is the balance between stocks and bonds. And as you get close to retirement, typically speaking, investors tend to have more allocation toward bonds, particularly if they don't have a pension. So it all depends. It's not a one size fits all. But typically what you see is that the more bonds you have, the smoother the ride. So the first thing that I will tell you is that the bond allocation matters a lot. The second thing that I will tell you is that because you have international and some small companies, the more the portfolio is not in the S&P, the more your performance, your individual performance will differ from what you see on the news. For example, if international companies are not doing as well as the U.S., then you would be probably a lower performance than the U.S. alone. Same with small companies. So, you know, I think that the fundamental premise is that somebody needs to invest the intellectual capital to understand exactly how their portfolio is invested and realize that they are not missing out on the S&P, because that is the largest part of their portfolio. Just that when you have other pieces alongside it, depending on how those pieces move, it's possible that you would have either better results or sometimes worse results than the S&P itself.
All right, very good. Well, this was terrific, Apollo. Thanks so much for you taking the time to join us. And I will hand it over to Rob to wrap it up. And thanks again.
It was great fun talking to you, John, as always. Thank you for having us.
Okay.
Thank you both very much for joining. This is a great conversation. I was glad we had the opportunity to extend it to our podcast here. For everyone listening, to learn more about Dimensional Fund Advisors, visit us.dimensional.com. To learn more about Team Hewins and how we serve clients, visit teamhewins.com. Thank you both very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
The content on this podcast is for informational purposes only and is of the personal opinion of the guest and host alone. It should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security. This podcast does not constitute a solicitation to enter into an investment agreement with Team Hewins. For more details, please visit teamhewins.com/terms of use. Market performance data cited in this podcast was sourced from Morningstar.